I am Plant on the Line in Vancouver, British Columbia at thecommentary.ca. Sam Weeb joins me again. He's got a new novel out, and it's terrific. Ocean Drive is set in White Rock, British Columbia, a seaside town close to the Canada-U.S. border. The airport is not too far, and the city of Surrey is closer. And it's a place ideal for criminal or nefarious elements. When the book begins, we meet Cameron Shaw, a paroled killer who was offered a job infiltrating the League of Nations crime syndicate. He turns down the offer, intending to go straight, but soon enough is drawn into this web after realizing he has no job, no family, or any prospects for either. While this is happening, we meet Megan Quick, an RCMP officer who's investigating a house fire where the body of Alexa Reed is found. As she delves into what happened, so begins Sam's book, a taut novel that's got criminals, the drug trade, brutal violence, all with this beautiful setting of White Rock. Sam Weeb is the author of the Wakeland novels, one of the most acclaimed detective series in Canada. His books have won all sorts of awards and gained loyal audiences here and abroad. As Nolan Chasey has just published another novel, A Lonesome Place for Dying. I'll ask him about that book and the taking on of a new persona. The website for more is at samweeb.com. Ocean Drive is from Harbor Publishing. We spoke 2.5 weeks ago. Please welcome back to the Plant Online program, Sam Weeb. Mr. Weeb, good morning.
Good morning, Joe.
Good morning. Thanks for joining us. Sam, as I told you just before we started, I'm enjoying the book a great deal, and I'm trying to figure out what's happening as we go along. Do you get that from readers a lot, that they're telling you what they're thinking about as they're reading the book? Do you get that a lot?
Sometimes, yeah. I'll get people just saying, you know, they're enjoying a particular part, or they're drawn into part of the story, yeah.
Does that influence how you'll write, though? I mean, if you'll hear from somebody, oh, I really like the way you developed such and such character, or you depicted such and such thing, when you're sitting down at your desk later, do you think about these comments from readers?
Well, sadly, by now it's too late to fix the book. But yeah, I mean, sometimes if something's particularly resonating with audiences, I'll think about not including more of it. But I mean, it's nice to know if it's working.
Mm. So when we meet Cam Shaw at the beginning of the book, he's just come out of prison. How long was he there for?
It's about a decade.
And he was quite young when he got in, right? 22, I think?
That's right. And even though he's committed murder, there were mildly extenuating circumstances that maybe weren't seen in his favor, because the person that he killed was quite a bigwig in White Rock.
Yeah, and there's a scene where he's filling out a form, and I guess he'd gone in for, it's called manslaughter, right?
Yes. Manslaughter.
So there is a circumstance there in the situation in that one scene he prefers manslaughter to murder, I guess, right?
Yeah, I mean, he's a killer, but the actual charge was manslaughter.
So as we meet him at the beginning of the book, he's transitioning back to society. He meets Zoe, a lawyer. So I was suspicious as to who she was, and I guess I should be as I continue reading the book, but I went back just last night and reread the first scene. She was put in touch with Cam through the parole officer. Is that right?
Well, she's part of a larger, perhaps nefarious scheme going on. So I don't want to spoil too much. But yes, she got in touch with him through his PO.
So does that happen often, where somebody who wants to get in touch with someone who's just gotten out of the house, that you can contact somebody like that?
Well, I think what I was trying to get at is that if somebody with power wants to have that conversation with you, they want access to your information, they're going to get it.
Yeah.
And Zoe is a very powerful person representing other powerful people. And they have their eye on Cam to infiltrate this this gang.
And the gang is called League of Nations, and it's a crime syndicate. What do they do?
What don't they do? They are connected to the ports and some of the smuggling going through there and distribution of drugs and other things going on of that nature.
So for people listening to us who aren't from this part of the world, even though White Rock, as beautiful as it is near the water and close to the border, there's no port there. But the border itself as a crossing, a land crossing especially, that's quite ideal for someone who's up to no good, right?
Yeah. I mean, White Rock is it's almost the perfect spot for some sort of criminal activity because it's on the border and it's right next to Surrey, which does have a port, and Delta and Richmond and Vancouver, and it's a real waypoint into and out of the country.
And it's such a wonderful setting because, you know, I know it from having been there a few times over the last little while. It's beautiful, as I said. There's a lot of wealth there. Its proximity to the border is appealing. And it's quite close to all these other places that you just mentioned, like Delta, like Surrey.
Yeah, it's a very, maybe overlooked place in a way. And that kind of made it the perfect place to set a real sprawling crime novel. I mean, in a way, my real influence was, have you ever seen the movie Fargo? That sort of idea of you take this setting which almost looks too nice, like nothing bad could ever happen here, and then you pull back and look at what's actually going on.
I love how you describe the place in the book. It's a place for the newlywed and the nearly dead.
Yes.
And I guess that's what makes up the sort of population there. Because I know a lot of old people have decided to move to White Rock to retire. But I guess I overlooked that there are obviously young people that live there too, right?
Yeah, I mean, my parents, I mean, our family moved there in 95, and my grandparents lived there before that.
Yeah.
They'd retired to White Rock. And it was definitely split between an older retired population and then young families that moved because it was cheap. And now, of course, 30 years later, it's just like the population has just sprouted up. And not only are there so many more people, but the amount of wealth there has just exploded. And you have these, you know, $10,000 a month retirement villas.
Yeah.
And, you know, luxury condos and all this very, stuff that just wasn't really there when I was a kid.
Yeah, for people listening to us elsewhere, they can just go to Google Maps and they can see what it looked like, 10, 15 years ago, and see all the developments and apartments that are sprouting up where houses once were, or empty lots even, right?
Yeah, I mean, there were no towers when I was a kid, and now it's all towers.
Yeah. And I was talking to someone recently about a lot of those houses there that where you can see they're on, well, there are a lot of hills there too. You can see right out to the ocean. I mean, it reminds people of California, you know, the wealthier parts of California, like Malibu, for example. And I guess that's a sort of lifestyle that Liz Garrick and her late husband, that's a sort of lifestyle that they had, right?
Yeah, Malibu is actually an excellent comparison because it does have that feeling of a rich enclave at parts.
Yeah. So I mentioned Liz. Her husband, Roger, we learn early in the book, dies, and Cam, I guess, has a hand in that, literally. What sort of, I guess, they are the wealthier characters in the book, right? The powerful as well?
Yeah, and they're the thread that ties Cam's story to Megan Quick, who's the staff sergeant in charge of the RCMP detachment there. So Liz is sort of the one person that is connected to both of them in different ways.
Yeah, and so Megan is a fascinating character because, as you mentioned, she's a police officer there, and we meet her for the first time because of a fire.
Yes. Yeah, so she's someone who is, I mean, almost like your quintessential small-town detective. And yeah. She's summoned to a fire, and there's a body in the fire, and it's a young college student that Megan knew. And the student's life has gone in a very dark direction, and Megan's very shocked by that. So she realizes that she doesn't really know the young people in this city yeah. and what the city's become. And as she starts investigating this murder, she's really starting to, you know, peel the layers off White Rock.
And what of what was happening in Megan's life just before the fire? What was happening that interests Megan at this point?
Well, she's she's divorced. She has a college-age son, and her wife or ex-wife has moved to Chicago. So she's also somebody sort of examining, you know, where does she fit in? And she's someone who grew up in White Rock, moved away to go to Depot and, you know, all the different places that you go when you're part of the RCMP. And then coming back to this hometown and being very conflicted about it. And, you know, somehow tied to a place and yet very critical of it.
Yeah, and she's bewildered by a lot of the changes that she's come back to, right?
Yeah, and I think that, you know, that's something that really struck me about White Rock in the last couple of years, is that, you know, I have a family member who is the victim of a home invasion.
Uh-huh.
There was a shooting a couple of weeks ago, like a gang shooting. This is really, like, Vancouver, downtown Vancouver crime, or Surrey crime.
Yeah.
That's on the streets of, you know, retired people's homes. I mean, it's just a shocking juxtaposition to me.
And this book, I notice, it, I don't want to say it's more violent than your previous books, but there is an element of violence in there that we read about, right?
Well, the Wakeland novels, I mean, the first one, Invisible Dead, is quite violent. Mm-hmm. And I pulled back from that a little bit just because it's not really interesting to me to depict a lot of violence. But this story warranted it. So I don't think it's over the top or anything like that.
No.
But it does try to depict, you know, some of what's going on in the world today.
Yeah, and I think that's important, you know, especially when we live in Vancouver, where there is, as you just mentioned a moment ago, a lot of these crimes that are happening, you know, close to us. I don't think it matters where you live in Metro Vancouver. There is something dangerous that's happened close to where one lives, right?
Yeah, absolutely.
And
I mean,
the whole
area is really changing.
Yeah, and the media doesn't get too graphic, and I think that's important that we not overlook what actually happens, right?
Yeah, definitely. I mean, you don't want to sugarcoat it, but you don't want to dwell on that or glorify it either.
In terms of the research that you do for a novel like this, I mean, you have some experience with White Rock itself, and you probably have had to go there in the course of writing this book. What else do you do when you write a book like Ocean Drive in terms of research, say?
Well, Joe, if I never went to White Rock again, I'd be pretty happy. you know, I still have family that live there.
Yeah.
So I've spent a lot of time out there. And then also, I mean, when it comes to things like the ports or gangs and stuff, I mean, reading, you know, Kim Boland is a great local reporter
yeah.
for The Sun.
Yeah.
Her work is great. There was a great book by Peter Edwards called The Wolf Pack about sort of millennial gangsters. So reading about that, talking to cops, talking to people involved in the, you know, the overdose crisis. And then also this book, I mean, some of Cam's jobs are just jobs that I had. I mean, obviously not the really crime heavy ones, but, you know, there's a part where he works at a warehouse
yeah.
and I had that job, and it was, you know, if you drop out of college thinking you're going to see the real world, like, go work in a warehouse for a year and you will re-enroll in college so quickly.
Yeah, I worked at a warehouse for about 2 weeks in high school. And looking back at it, I didn't mind the job itself. I mean, you know, I was much younger then, so, you know, the physical stuff wasn't that bad. The people were fascinating to talk to. And the 2 weeks drew to a close, you know, there were people coming up to me and saying, you know, you shouldn't be here. You really shouldn't. You shouldn't end up here. And which I thought was kind of them, you know what I mean? But as you depicted in the book, yeah, it is a fascinating set of circumstances that lead people there. And Cam certainly understands how he doesn't want to be there at the same time, right?
Yeah, well, I mean, there's, like, the job itself is, I mean, it's good, honest work.
Right.
But in the story, at least, there's also this nefarious gang influence of, you know, using this, because it's, you know, stuff coming off the ports, ending up in a warehouse before it's shipped out, it's kind of the perfect place for them to infiltrate. And that's what Cam gets caught up in. But, you know, there's a lot of danger in that work. And, you know, frankly, I don't think WorkSafe does a great job of policing and looking over some of those things. And, yeah, I mean, it's obviously it's very complex, but it was brutal.
Yeah. Your skills as a writer are on display, certainly in all your work, but in Ocean Drive in particular, your skill at writing dialogue suggests that's a part of the work that you enjoy. In terms of getting it right when it comes to how people talk, you obviously have talked to a variety of people over the years, and so you're able to get that. But, I mean, is it something that you actually enjoy doing?
Oh, yeah. Dialogue is one of the chief joys of crime fiction because it's so colorful and it draws from different, different jargons and slangs, and yet it has a poetry to it, and cadence. So I love it, yeah.
And the other thing that you do, because we meet in the book a variety of people, and just from the names alone, different cultural extractions, if you will, in terms of writing dialogue like that, with that in mind, because I can read accents as I'm reading your book and read how they sound even. It's such a skill that you have that I can't overstress just how well you do that on the page, say.
Oh, thank you so much.
So how do you do that though? Because if I'm telling a story to somebody, I can probably mimic an accent. But how do you do that when you're writing?
Well, I mean, I think the big thing is to not to never be making fun of someone.
Yeah.
Because I just read this quote today that anybody speaking English for a second language means they know two languages.
Yeah.
Like at least one more than I know.
Yeah.
And so trying to avoid that, but capturing the particular rhythm, which is cool. And and I think there's like a beauty to the way that different groups, speak English. So just trying to keep my ears open and talking to people and also just trying to find something in those characters that I can relate to and that, that makes them unique. So they're not representing a group, but they're an individual. I think that's really important.
Yeah, you capture the speech patterns, which I think is, not necessarily just accents, if you will, but the way people talk, even the way that they curse. I find that fascinating because even if you think about Metro Vancouver, the way people curse in Surrey is probably a little bit different than they do in downtown Vancouver. Not that much, but I think you can pick up sometimes where people are from or where they grew up. By the way, they use the F word, for example.
Yeah, it's a great shibboleth for where people come from. Absolutely. Yeah.
When you write a novel like this, Sam, I can't help but think that you're holding up a mirror to a place and a time, especially where it's set and when it's set. Are you saying something in fiction about the way things are? I mean, or did you? I mean, it seems like you are as a reader. I'm getting that as a reader. But as a writer, when you sit at your desk, do you set out to say something about the way things are?
Well, the most important thing is that it's a good story. I mean, it's entertainment, and if it fails at entertainment, it fails as a book. So it's definitely not supposed to be like a lesson or a moral, but it is grounded in stuff that I see going on today, and that is definitely important to me. And I feel like, a lot of literary fiction and a lot of what sort of gets into the culture ignores that. Like I was saying with the, the home invasion. I mean, you'd never think of that until it happens to someone close to you. Yeah. And then you watch, this happened in Surrey right during this transition from the RCMP to the municipal Surrey force. Mm-hmm. And this elderly victim is going to do the identikit, putting together a face, and there's no one at the precinct. So, I mean, to me, that's so fascinating and haunting that there's this kind of, almost like a crime fighter free zone that's been created in a way. So, yeah, I definitely want to throw a spotlight on that. And also, it's just I'm shaped by the experiences that I had with those jobs and, going to high school in White Rock, and that definitely comes out in this book.
And when we're talking now in the middle of April, there have been shootings. Thankfully, not as frequent, but frequent enough that it makes the news, every few days, every week at least, throughout Metro Vancouver. We seem to always be living in a time where gangs are fighting with one another, and the rest of us are worried about getting caught in the crossfire, and unfortunately some people do, don't they?
Yeah, and I think that that's also just a perennial concern that, when I was a kid, the Bindi Joe Hall shooting was big in the news, and, there's been biker stuff, and there's been cartel stuff, and it does just kind of cycle around.
And I'm sure you get people that come up to you and who'll read your stuff, enjoy it a great deal, and then be surprised that all this stuff is happening, close to them.
Yeah, I think that people get a kick out of that, and maybe a bit of a shock, too.
Yeah. I guess that's the other thing that we overlook, being a port city, and it's always been like this, going back to the time that Vancouver was founded. The criminal element does seem to do well in these parts just because of geography, right?
Yeah, well, also, Canada has very, very different and, in some cases, very baffling laws about international crime and evidence and, using, confidential informants and stuff. So it's, in some cases, that it's actually looked at as kind of a crime paradise for people to come and not suffer the consequences so much. And, I don't know what to do with that information, but it's a factor that has definitely shaped the Lower Mainland.
And it makes for good material for a novel, doesn't it?
There really is a never-ending source, yes.
Yeah. You there's a disclaimer in this book about, and we see this in all sorts of novels, that the resemblance to real people is a coincidence. Is that difficult for you to say create new stories or new characters, even when there are criminal stories that we read about all the time that are usually unbelievable at times,
I'm trying to think how to answer that.
Do you find situations, Sam, where you're having to when you hear about something that might be interesting for fodder for a book, have to work a little harder in terms of changing some of the details so that it's not about a particular story you heard, say.
Well, I never base anything one-on-one on a story, but certain things inspire it. But, you know, an awful lot of fiction writing is thinking about, you know, what doesn't end up in the news story at all. Like, where do those kinds of characters come from? What's going on in their heads? What kind of pressures do they face? You know, so, like, that kind of stuff is part of the job. I try not to just, you know, slap different names on stuff and throw it in the book. I mean, that would be dishonest, and I'd probably get sued. But, you know, it's definitely inspired by the, more than anything, just the climate. You know, just that sense of, like, there's something going on in a town like White Rock that most people don't know about.
Yeah, and those of us that will have to go through that part of the world will probably look at it a little bit different after having read Ocean Drive, I think. and that's the fun part about going to a lot of these places that you write about once again. Since we last talked, Sam, you took on a new persona in the guise of Nolan Chase. Have you published one book already under that name?
Well, it comes out in May, on May 7th, and it's called A Lonesome Place for Dying, and it's the first book in a new series about a small town police detective named Ethan Brand, who is somebody's trying to kill him. So it's a little bit lighter than the Wakeland novels.
Uh-huh.
It's more of a Longmire, you know, small-town detective series. But, yeah, I'm really excited about that. And it's set in Washington State. So.
I see. Yeah. I'm sure you're asked this all the time, but why take on a new, say, pen name for that series, say, as opposed to your own?
Well, if anybody knows me at all, and they probably don't, they know me as a writer of Canadian private eye fiction, neither of which are top-selling genres, either Canadian fiction or PI fiction. So this allows me to start over in the States with a small-town mystery series and see if people want to read it on the quality alone, which is kind of nice.
Yeah. And do you feel like a different person? I mean, when you're sitting at your desk writing Ethan, as opposed to, say, Wakefield or you know, the characters in Ocean Drive, say?
I mean, no, I'm not putting on a persona, but, you know, Wakeland is a first-person private detective series, so it's very close to how I view the world, even though Wakeland's not like me as a person. Ocean Drive is its own thing, because it's much more of a sprawling, multi-character story. And then with the Ethan Brand series, it's in third person, so there's a little bit of a distance, and he's a little bit more of a straight-up hero, you know, more of like a Clint Eastwood type. So, you know, as much as I wish that was me in real life, that's probably more of a fictional extension.
But the writing itself, do you write differently? I mean, different time of day even? I mean, are you juggling writing projects at the same time that you do have to, say, divorce yourself from other things so that you can focus your attention on one thing, say?
Yeah, there's definitely an overlap. And, you know, one of the things that I'll do, just as a little shorthand, is come up with playlists of, you know, music that kind of fits the story. So with Sunset and Jericho and Ocean Drive, it's a lot of Pacific Northwest bands. It's a lot of alt rock and jazz and kind of, you know, more atmospheric music. And then with the Ethan Brand novel, it was 80s country music, which I also love. And so it's kind of nice to get to unapologetically, you know, talk about the Judds and Randy Travis and all that.
Yeah, I love country music as well, and I can see how that might work as a writer. And in terms of Ocean Drive, what were you listening to?
Oh, man. It's hard to think back to the beginning, but you know, Nick Cave is one of my go-tos. No Means No, and a lot of the local jazz musicians. I love Ingrid Jensen, Brad Turner, Chris Gestrin is great. So a lot of that kind of music. And then just classics like, you know, Bill Evans and Miles Davis and that kind of stuff.
Yeah, you know, I'm asking these things because as I finish Ocean Drive, I'm going to put some of these things on as I'm listening, especially the things that have no words, especially. But yeah, I mentioned Dave a moment ago. I refer to him as Dave Wakefield. It's Wake Lynn. Will we see him again?
Absolutely. He's going to come back next year.
Oh, that's great. I can't ask you, though, how we'll see him, though, can I?
Well, all I can say is that at the end of Sunset in Jericho, he makes a decision whether to leave or to stay in Vancouver. And the impetus for the new book is what happens if he comes back. Not saying he does, but that was the impetus. So, I'm really excited about that one, too.
Yeah, a lot of people I know are as well. In terms of the characters in Ocean Drive, I mean, I'm not finished this book yet, but I can see how rich they are and how they, too, might return. Will they?
I don't know. The nice thing about a book like this is that you have so many pieces on the board that, yeah, maybe Megan Quick will show up in something else, or maybe Cam will. But the other thing is that you can put them in a final place. And I don't mean to say they die, but but there's the threat of that. And I think that there is something nice about that as opposed to a series character where, you know, as bad as Wakeland's life gets, I'm probably not going to kill him on page 30.
Mm-hmm. Right? Yeah.
So never say never, but I don't have plans for a sequel at the moment.
Well, I'm enjoying it a great deal, and I just can just imagine how fans of yours will enjoy Ocean Drive as well. So it's always good to talk again. Congratulations on this book, as well as good luck with the upcoming Ethan Brand novel.
Thank you so much, Joe.
The website for more is at samweeb.com. Ocean Drive is from Harbor Publishing. It's author Sam Weeb. Join me on the line from New Westminster. In Vancouver, I'm Joseph Planta.